From the studio of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson. My usual co-host Chris Cherniak is out of town this week, so Katie Wang, executive director of the Park City Film Series, is here to join me. Thanks, Katie.
Great to be here, Nell. During the first half of the show today, we'll be speaking with Fiona Stafford, professor of English language and literature at Oxford University, and author of the Sunday Times Nature Book of the Year. It's called The Long, Long Life of Trees, and it's a lyrical tribute to the diversity of trees, their incredible histories and characteristics, and ever-evolving meanings in our society.
Since the beginnings of history, trees have served humankind in countless useful ways, but our relationship with trees has many dimensions beyond mere practicality. Trees are so entwined with human experience that diverse species have inspired their own stories, myths, songs, poems, paintings, and spiritual meanings. Some have even achieved status as religious, cultural, and national symbols. In The Long, Long Life of Trees, Stafford offers detailed explorations of 17 common trees, from ash and apple to pine, oak, cypress, and willow.
During the second half of the show, we'll turn our attention to a local topic, the environmental and outdoor education program at the Park City Day School. Humanities teacher Robin McGuinn and Leo Mosher, head of the outdoor education program, will be here to share with us how they bring these concepts into their programs across all disciplines and nurture a love of the environment with our students.
Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Katie Wang.
And joining us in the first half of the show is Fiona Stafford. She is professor of English at the University of Oxford, where she teaches literature, listens to students, writes about poetry, novels, identity, literary history, art, and the environment, edits classic novels, and takes walks among the trees. She's also the author and presenter of the highly acclaimed The Meaning of Trees for BBC Radio's The Essay. She's married with two children and lives in Buckinghamshire, where she's joining us from today. Fiona, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, let's start with this. Tell us about your motivation to write this book, The Long, Long Life of Trees. How did you choose this subject? Why was this calling to you?
Well, I've always been interested in trees. I think a lot of people are, though they don't necessarily always read it, realize it. And as someone who works with literature, I read lots of older novels where there's lots of reference to trees. And I became increasingly interested in the very different ways in which human beings related to trees, not just living trees, but also the different uses of wood. There are different writers who were very aware of what different timbers were for. And it struck me that that was an interesting topic. So I started working on this. And the more I thought about it, and the more I read, and the more I talked to people, the more I realized it was a very, very rich and international topic.
And the book highlights 17 different tree species. How did you choose which ones to include?
Well, being UK-based, I was thinking, because part of this grows from a series of radio essays I did, and I was thinking of trees that people would recognise. I thought that was an interesting way to go, because I think there's always something exciting when you hear about something that is very familiar to you, and then you suddenly discover there are all sorts of aspects of it that hadn't occurred to you. So that was part of my thinking to begin with, and then as the project grew, I thought it was actually interesting to look at other kinds of trees, like the olive, for example, which isn't a UK native at all. It's really what kind of defines the Mediterranean. So there were various different kind of principles that were influencing my choice. And I wanted to write about different trees too, different kinds of trees. So a fruit tree, an evergreen, a broadleaf, trees that were long-lived, trees that were shorter-lived, that, you know, different kinds really.
So this may be an unfair question. I guess it's like asking a parent which is their favorite child. But I'd love to hear which of the trees perhaps is your favorite, maybe one that maybe in an unexpected way became your favorite as you started writing the book, and to hear a little bit about the tree. Because what I think is so lovely about your book is that you bring to light aspects about trees that probably maybe we kind of know but didn't really know we knew, or, you know, that some trees like the pine tree, kind of the workhorse tree as you describe it, have so many different uses that are so intertwined that I find fascinating. I'd love to give people kind of a flavor of what you present in the book.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I mean, to choose one tree out of 17, it is, as you say, it is like choosing a favorite child. You don't have one, but different trees appeal for different reasons, so perhaps we could put it that way. I did, as you say, with the pine tree, find it fascinating that there were so many different things that are derived from the pine, which I hadn't really thought a lot about until I started working on the book. I mean, I obviously realized that you know, pines were used for timber and that kind of thing, but I hadn't really thought about tar and pitch and rosin for violin strings. All of these different things derived from the pine. It's fascinating. So that's an interesting tree for those sorts of reasons. But then the willow tree I find very interesting as well. It's got a very long history, and there are different kinds of willows, and they're just very, very beautiful trees. So that's another kind of aesthetic response we might have to trees. And then there's the oak, for example, which is just a kind of magnificent tree, so sort of strong, and its canopy is so rich. There's so many leaves, and I think with an oak tree, because of all the leaves and because of the age of these trees, they are really a kind of whole civilization in themselves. That's another thing that isn't immediately apparent when we look at trees. I mean, you might see butterflies or you might see an odd bird, but you don't necessarily realize just the number of different insects and birds and animals that are all dependent on this tree. So there's a whole kind of culture that's actually rather separate from the human world, and I think that's extremely interesting in a different way. And that's before you start looking at all the kind of symbolism that human beings have piled onto these trees, which is of course one of my starting points.
Well, yeah, speaking of that symbolism, you talk about some of this ancient mythology and the ways that trees were so integral to it. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what I found very interesting was that some of the ancient mythology, for example, the oak tree was associated with Zeus in the classical world, and supposedly his oracles were interpreted through the rustle of oak leaves. But also Zeus associated with lightning strikes. And of course, the oak tree is a tree that does get physically struck by lightning. So very often I was finding that the traditional mythical associations, the symbols of trees, were to do with something about their physical property, and I found that very interesting. The oak tree has always been associated with strength and stability, and kind of often it's rather gendered as well. It's seen as a kind of manly tree, and that has to do with the kind of the hardness of the timber and the fact that it was the best kind of wood to use for shipbuilding. So if you're going off to conquer another land, not that would be at all what I particularly wanted to do. If you were going to, you'd want to go in an oak built ship. So these associations that we have, which we might think of as actually rather removed from the physical origin, are completely bound up with all sorts of properties that the trees have.
I say one of my favorite trees, of course, is the cherry tree, which we don't have as much here. But I went to school in D.C., so just your imagery of the basin, the tidal basin with all the beautiful cherry trees there, and just the ephemeralness of those blossoms I thought was so lovely. I wonder if you could describe a little bit, there was a part in your book that I won't do justice to, but there's a grove that you describe that's kind of a meditative grove, but for, I think it was World War II, World War One?
Oh, it was World War One. You're probably thinking of the Tree Cathedral at Whipsnade.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, it is absolutely beautiful, and it's a rather moving story. It was planted after the First World War, considerably after the First World War, in the 1930s, actually, by somebody who'd been a soldier in the Western Front, but he'd survived, whereas lots of his comrades hadn't. And he wanted a tribute that would somehow do justice to the fallen, and yet also be a kind of pledge of hope for the future, and he had the idea of planting a cathedral that would be alive and growing, and he used different kinds of trees to plant out this amazing cathedral, which is now growing in just the way he'd hoped. And for the Easter Chapel, he planted cherry trees because he knew that they would be at their best just at that springtime of the year. So it's an incredibly sort of beautiful place. I mean, now the cherry trees are kind of much fatter than they were when he planted these little saplings, but they've gone on, and year after year they're sort of confirming that hope that he had.
I just love that imagery. I mean, it just kind of brings you, you know, just the kind of with the religious significance, kind of closer to God, closer to spirituality, but through nature. I mean, I think to me that's just such a lovely metaphor. I was intrigued to see to hear that, I guess, the holly tree has been around for 100 million years.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. And not, you know, not all trees have, but the holly is one of those oldest ones, which is why I was kind of imagining it in the time of the dinosaurs, and it just seemed quite a suitable tree for that. It's such a kind of feisty, prickly, self-possessed sort of tree. I thought, you know, if anything was going to cope with dinosaurs, it would be the holly tree.
Right, fight off that T-Rex.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Hand-to-hand combat. So you talk about some of these ancient trees and also some trees that individual trees that have incredibly long lifespans that, you know, entire sort of cultures have almost been built around. You talk about a cowrie tree that was important to the Maori culture and a few others. You know, choose an example or two and talk to us about some of these really, really old trees. Maybe that's where the book title comes from, The Long, Long Life of Trees.
Yes, I mean that is where it comes from, really. I mean, and it's partly inspired by yew trees, which are the you know, the first chapter of the book, actually, after the introduction. I talk about yew trees because this was something I hadn't known until I started to do the research. I mean, I knew yew trees were old, and certainly in the UK, you often find them in churchyards, and they're big, fat old trees. But it turns out that often the trees were there before the churchyard because they're so old, and that seemed to me quite an astonishing thought. Again, it links up, I suppose, a little bit with the you know, the idea of the cherry trees having that religious significance, even though their blossom is so much shorter lived. That the yew trees have a different kind of religious significance, in that they, in a way, are trees that represent everlasting life because they have this extraordinary capacity to regenerate. So you can actually have yew trees that are thousands of years old. There's one in the mountains in Wales that is maybe 4,000 years old.
Wow.
Quite extraordinary. And when you go and see these trees, they just do have an amazing kind of presence, really. It's very kind of chastening, I think, to us to be in the presence of something that's still living and has been there for so many thousands of years.
You imagine all the things that tree would have, the stories the tree could tell.
That's
could it
right.
Be able to talk.
Yeah,
the things
well,
seen.
Well, one of the trees, one of the old yew trees, which is not that far from London, it's just on the banks of the Thames, and it not only witnessed the signing of the Magna Carta in 1215, but then, you know, a few hundred years later, it witnessed Henry VIII courting Anne Boleyn there, and it's still there. It's extraordinary to think of trees that have witnessed all these historic events.
So to kind of bring it to the present day, one thing you talk about is the environmental benefit of trees. I mean, certainly, you know, there's the cultural significance, the spiritual significance, but you know, the environmental benefit. When we think about beautifying cities, we often talk about planting trees. You know, we have in the centerways of you know, boulevards, that there was these beautiful London plane trees where I'm from. But also, you know, as a carbon sink, I think kind of is a more kind of contemporary relationship. So I'd love to kind of hear more about that, about trees, kind of that benefit of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the benefits of trees in modern cities are, you know, only just really being properly recognised. You know, if we're worried about air quality and urban heat islands, this kind of thing. I mean, trees definitely improve all of these urban problems. So there are kind of physical benefits. You know, they're releasing oxygen, so they're cleaning the air and things, and they provide shade, all of these sort of practical things. But there's also a lot of evidence to suggest that green spaces in cities improve the kind of general health of the local population. I think there are mental health benefits, which are enormous and only just beginning to be understood because of these very sort of soothing spaces, but also physical ones, because people tend to just get out and go for a walk if there's a nice kind of leafy area. So it tends to make people physically fitter. And also, I think when people are out, they kind of meet other people. It increases sociability. So lots of the kind of problems associated with modern urban living are actually hugely kind of addressed just by creating nice spaces with mature trees.
And along those same lines, I mean, you talk about how trees have been gathering places. You know, they're not just gathering places now in cities where you want a little shade or you want to see some leafy green, but they've been these gathering places for hundreds and thousands of years.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's something that they still have, that kind of pull. I think a big mature tree, people are naturally drawn to gather around it. And I think that goes back for centuries. There's lots and lots of examples of that historically. But I think we can see an impulse in that way when people have a Christmas tree and you know, the family gather around it or the town gathers around it. There is just something about trees that attracts people. I think it's something quite natural, actually. So they are essentially communal things to enjoy, as well as obviously beautiful, quiet places where you can sit and think your own thoughts. They have that other much more kind of communal, sociable aspect.
I loved an example you included in the book. In Slovenia, there's an enormous linden tree, and it was the legendary site where retreating Turkish invaders were said to have left their golden spoons. And now today, it's still a venue for major events, including like the annual political assembly and these very modern events.
Exactly, and there are kind of lots of examples of that kind of thing. So I think if people are enlightened enough to kind of leave their ancient trees in place when they have those sort of associations, it gives a great sort of sense of continuity. And I think for a country like Slovenia that's had, you know, really quite a lot of invasions and things over the years, some sort of symbol like that, which suggests continuity and stability in a nation, is very attractive. I mean, I think it's you could relate that to Lebanon wanting, you know, to sort of think of the cedar as its national symbol. You know, I think a lot of nations are associated with a tree, but I think especially if you're a nation that's somehow been invaded by bigger nations, they become really, really important.
Our neighbor to the north, of course, Canada, is strongly associated with the maple, right? That maple leaf. How was that chosen? I mean, was that like a conscious decision to choose the maple to represent certain things?
Yeah, I think it was it was something. There was a competition, and there was a kind of agreement that the maple leaf would be a good choice for this independent nation, you know, no longer a British colony, and the maple is a very, very kind of striking symbol, and it's a native tree. But again, I think there is that sense that it draws together people, because obviously Canada is a huge country, so a symbol that would draw people together, even though they might be hundreds of miles apart, they could still feel connected by this leaf. And I think the symbol of a leaf as well is very kind of reassuring, because they return every year. So I think there's all sorts of reasons why it works very well. And the design is brilliant, isn't it? I mean, it must be one of the most recognizable flags in the world, I would say.
Right. And absolutely. Who doesn't love maple syrup?
Yeah, exactly.
It brings another tree that does a dual duty.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious. I mean, I think all of us in this room, in this conversation, you know, are tree lovers. I can't imagine not being a tree lover. But certainly, you know, there is a history of trees being cut down and, kind of abused. Do you see a resurgence, in urban centers and kind of cultures around the world of bringing back trees and recognizing their importance, that they are not just, nice to look at, but they have all these other benefits that we've talked about, and that there's kind of a reason to kind of embrace the tree again?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, I think there are all these kind of historical benefits which probably have more influence on us still than we always realize. I think culture does continue to matter a lot and shape the way people think. But I think the kind of environmental arguments for planting trees are just kind of huge. And I didn't even mention the kind of whole question about sustainable fuel. So tree planting is, could well be the future. So I think for all kinds of reasons, people are beginning to see that. But there's still, the kind of argument that trees fall on cars and so they need to be cut down, or trees upset pavements, and all of those reasons why councils routinely chop them down. And I think one of the things, as tree lovers, as we all are, we have to kind of remember is that sometimes trees do need to be thinned, or they need to be pruned, they need to be looked after, and then they're a huge benefit. Certainly over here in the UK, we're all kind of raising awareness of trees at the moment. That there's the Woodland Trust, which is one of the big charities, is going to launch a tree charter in the autumn, and that is setting out reasons why trees are important for the future. And it's interesting how many different kind of organisations are becoming interested in that. So I'm quite optimistic actually about the sort of raising of tree consciousness.
So before we let you go, I have to ask if you've been surprised by the response to the book, and then you also created this series for BBC Radio called The Meaning of Trees, which became hugely popular, and the book was named the Sunday Times Nature Book of the Year. Did this take you by surprise, or did you kind of think with all the hype about trees, I guess, that this might be a hot topic?
Yeah, that wasn't why I wrote it at all. I have been absolutely astonished by how nice everybody's been about it. Actually, no, it's been a real surprise, and I think it is because people love trees. And one of the nice things about it has been all the kind of letters and messages and conversations I've had with people who've read the book and then started to tell me about a particular tree that was hugely meaningful in their life, or one they remember from childhood, or some recipe associated with a tree product, and it's just been absolutely lovely. And I think that's why the book's been successful, is that lots of people are interested in trees. It's just they haven't always realised that they are, and then suddenly they think, oh yeah, of course. They're so important.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. That's Fiona Stafford, the author of The Long, Long Life of Trees. We hope to talk with you again soon.
Thank you very much.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back in the second half of the show to turn to a local topic. We'll be talking about the environmental and outdoor education philosophy at the Park City Day School. We are going to take a quick break for a few underwriters, and then we'll be back.
This is Allison Kulo with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with benefits, from lodging projections, educational videos, group sales leads, and a listing on the top travel site for Park City, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining can be found at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Katie Wang.
And joining us right here in the studio for the second half of the show is Robin McGinn, the humanities teacher at Park City Day School, as well as Leo Mosier, the head of outdoor education there. And we're talking with them today about environmental and outdoor education philosophy at the school. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for,
having,
for us.
Now, Leo, you just returned from a trip with some students. Is that right?
Yes, we just got back from Moab. We spent 4 days there with the fifth grade.
What a wonderful way to end the year. I'm jealous. So let's start by talking about just the overall philosophy of environmental and outdoor education there. Robin, you've told us that it kind of spreads across all disciplines. It's not just a specific class.
It's definitely not just a specific class. Leo is probably the best person to talk about it as our new outdoor education coordinator. He's been leading trips for years at the school, but it really is, we have trips at the beginning of the year in the middle school, we have trips at the end of the year in the lower school and the middle school, and it really is kind of a way to bookend the whole year and really get the kids on board with what we're putting out there. It really brings them together as a group. We do a lot of team building kind of things, but it also really anchors them to this place, to Utah, and to appreciate the environmental values that we have here.
So one example, on our fifth grade trip, before we left, each of the students chose a plant or an animal that we were likely to see while we were down there, and then they did some research on it, and then were able to present when we saw those critters on our hikes. So they were doing research and public presentation. And
nice. So is this a new program or philosophy for the Park City Day School? I have to say I've not kind of thought of the Park City Day School of having this very strong outdoor environmental link before, and maybe that's just because I've not been paying attention, but I'm curious, is this something new, and kind of how new is it, and why? Why now, and how did it all get started?
Sure. It's not a new program. We've been doing it since the merger of Colby School and Park City Academy, and Colby School had a pretty active outdoor ed program before that. We're trying to develop it a little more now to get the kids out more.
Yeah, it's it's been going for a long time. A lot of our camping gear is still labeled with the names of the two previous schools, so it was definitely a part of the values of both Park City Academy and Colby School before the merger even. But like Leo said, we're hoping to really kind of increase the focus on this. Our new head of school, Ian Crossland, who's coming in next month, is really gung-ho with this idea, and he has a lot of experience with outdoor ed. So it's a great program that we've already got. I'm new to the school. This is my second year as a teacher there, and I've been amazed with what can happen with kids on camping trips and everything like that, and it's just growing, and it's a really cool focus for the school to have.
But you also do place-based outdoor education. I mean, you have gardens. I live near the day school, so I see your greenhouse that I know came over from the Colby School. So can you speak a little bit to that? Because it's certainly, you know, it's enticing to think, oh, we go to Moab, we go away, but you know, there's so much nature nearby. It's intriguing how you've integrated that as well.
There is a ton of nature nearby, and the outdoor education program for the younger kids, obviously we're not going to take kindergartners away from their parents for long trips or anything. You know, I actually have
for
a
your
kindergartner.
Your own sanity's sake, yes.
Guiding them through the deserts of the sun.
I have a kindergartner at the school, and so I know the whole class of them. That'd be a bit much for camping, right? They're not quite there yet, but the outdoor ed program extends down to our youngest students, and they stay near the campus, and they do activities that are age appropriate but adventurous. And so we live right, or our school's right at the base of Ecker Hill. The kindergartners go and climb it. They go up all the way to the flagpole, and they pack themselves snacks and they create their own trail mix. And so, you know, they are really getting into that same kind of experience, but without the overnight aspect, and they're outdoors, they're learning about, my son this year, he had a project and he learned about a native Utah animal and he learned about a squirrel and he made an art project with it. And he learned and made this report and presented and then actually had his art on display at the Kimball Art Center, which was really cool. And when he went on his end of year hike up Ecker Hill, he actually talked about how his animal was there and how his classmates' animals, they saw them as well. And so really it's something that is kind of carried throughout, not just in the middle school and the upper lower school grades where they can go on these camping trips, but we're really using the location that we have right there at Pine Brook at the base of Ecker Hill to, you know, get the kids engaged and involved.
So, Leo, talk about some of the experiences that some of the older kids have. What kinds of adventures you take them on?
Sure. Our eighth graders spent a week at Lake Powell. So we stay at Lone Rock Campground, which is an adventure. It gets a little windy there. and they tour Glen Canyon Dam. We hike Lower Antelope Canyon. We go to the Toadstools. And connect that with... their history studies. So they study the water use in the West and issues with water rights and whatnot. After the dam tour, you know, they have a chance to talk to people who that is their life, is taking care of water there. And then they write letters to public officials explaining their feelings on it and what they would like to see happen with water use in the West. And we've actually gotten responses in the past from those politicians. So where did we go with seventh grade?
The first step Zion. Towards civic action.
Zion.
That's right.
Yeah, we go to Zion and hike the Narrows. We've done the subway with them as well. We're getting to be a little bit too big to take a group through the subway anymore, and permits are getting hard to get.
But yeah.
So we're going to try canyoneering with them instead.
Nice. Well, it's really impressive, I think, how much those students can absorb and think critically about some of these issues. We had some of Robin's students on talking about an initiative. You know, they're trying to help save Bonanza Flats. And to hear their perspective and to hear them speak on the subject was incredible. I know, you know, you think of it like, oh, it's just, you know, it's just middle schoolers working on a little school project, but it's so impressive what they can do. So maybe give us an example of some of the other, I know you have specific projects and initiatives they're working on. What else are they doing in class?
Next year, we're actually going to take the integration of their grade level themes in the middle school into the OE trips. And this is something that we're working on. So we haven't actually, this is brand new for next year. Each of the middle school grades has, and actually each of the grades throughout the entire school has a theme, which is maybe a word or a phrase or an idea. In the middle school, the sixth grade theme is Common Ground, and the seventh grade theme is Justice, and the eighth grade theme is Enduring Change. And so we have planned out these units that are going to kind of be kicked off through their OE trip and carried on throughout the first quarter, where they are studying a problem that's related to their grade level theme. So the sixth graders, their theme is Common Ground. In their trip to Escalante, they are going to actually go into a deep study that connects to the science curriculum, which is astronomy, not astrology. I almost said the wrong word. I was like, oh my gosh,
don't say the wrong word. Oh, that'll be interesting.
Yeah. So they learn about the stars and how the planet works with the moons and how the stars moving in the sky, what that actually means and what's actually happening there. And so they're using that as kind of the organizing concept of this idea of common ground and studying cultures and how cultures have used the stars to tell myths and to navigate and all the other different functions. So they're going to be actually out camping, looking at the stars, using star finders to identify constellations, and then talking about cultural values of those stars as well and how they've been used in similar ways across time and history by different cultures, which is really cool. And so that's going to be something that starts out in the OE trip and then is brought back into the science classroom and the literature classroom and the history classroom as well. We've got similar projects that could go on and on. We've got one plan for seventh grade and one plan for eighth grade as well. But that's definitely something that we try to make sure that things are not just isolated into one class. Like, this is what we're learning in math today. And Leo's great with that because he uses math to help the kids learn how to build things. It's not just this subject. These are skills that can be applied across the different curriculum areas and across your life in general.
So I have to ask the question, because I'm sure people are thinking this. Certainly, I would imagine the response from the kids is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, who wouldn't want to go to Grand Staircase Escalante and look at stars and all of that? But what do you hear back from the parents? I mean, we're in this age of just unbelievable testing. My daughter's in fourth grade, and she just finished SAGE testing for seemingly forever, in her perspective. I have no idea how long it was, maybe two
never
weeks.
Ending.
Never ending. But in this age of just testing and scores and how do you measure up and, you know, how does that fit into what you're doing? How does that fit into the testing or not? And kind of what's the response been for the parents? Because I imagine there had to have been some trepidation in the beginning of, is my kid really gonna be able to go to Harvard if they, you know, are out looking at stars?
Right.
How does that all work?
So the things that we do on Outdoor Ed, we're working on critical thinking skills and working together as a team, approaching things from different directions, which really helps with testing, because you're instead of just filling in bubbles, you can think about the answers that you're doing. And I would say we go beyond testing quite a bit, because we're looking at building all sorts of skills. We don't just want students who are really good test takers. We want our students to be able to approach their world in a thoughtful way, and their peers and how they work together with each other.
Yeah. The answer is not always C.
The answer is not always C. And as an independent school, it's amazing to have that freedom to not be tied down to, whatever some test writer somewhere has decided they need to know. We can have the flexibility to say these are, and we do have a set of very stringent standards of these are the things that we want our students to learn, but we have the freedom to get them there in maybe some non-traditional sort of ways. And in addition to the other things that Leo mentioned, I feel like soft skills are so important. It's a huge buzzword that employers are saying nowadays, are having those leadership skills and communication skills and collaboration skills. And those are things that we really focus on, because they are the things that help people grow and become leaders and people who can make a difference.
One thing I thought that was really interesting in your curriculum, and I know it's your five values.
Yes.
Thank you. That one of them is compassion.
Yes.
Which I thought is, really interesting and kind of amazing. And how do you get children to be more compassionate? I'd love to teach my children to not beat on each other when they get upset with them.
Sure. On our trips, it's really easy to help kids learn compassion, because we're in a situation that they're not comfortable with generally. A lot of them have never gone camping before, so everything is brand new and challenging, and they don't necessarily understand it. So one of my favorite parts of the trip is watching them set up tents together.
That is a bonding experience.
It takes a long time.
Hopefully bonding and not. But to see them, you know, get frustrated and help each other work through it and understand that someone doesn't have the same set of skills that you have. So here's where you're strong and you can help them. And later when it comes to, you know, cooking tacos for dinner, you might be really good with dicing onions and they may not. So helping them look at to see how they can help each other get through this entire week. Hikes are challenging, you know, packing meals is challenging, and they just have so many opportunities to help each other out with that.
Sleeping away from home is challenging. That's a place where I see a lot of compassion amongst the kids, is each night somebody's homesick, and usually it's a different person each night, and each night they jump in and they help each other out and they bring each other through it and they support each other, and that carries over into the rest of the school year, where they can just kind of have that community of like, we're in this together. And, you know, doesn't mean that they're not ever unkind to each other, because all humans are, but it's something that they kind of really learn to look out for each other, which is really special.
It is special, and I think it's something that many people will probably relate to in this community, right? Many of us are outdoorsy, many of us go camping, mm-hmm. backpacking, and have had those special experiences that bond you to, you know, another set of mm-hmm. humans, and it's hard to explain exactly how it happens. But Leo, circling back to your role, I'm curious, is the outdoor education your full-time role there? Are you also, do you teach a specific grade? Tell us about how you work with other teachers to bring that outdoor education into every grade.
Sure. This year I was a fifth grade teacher as well. Next year, outdoor education is my job, or experiential education.
Okay.
So what I'll do, I'll be working on planning more trips, more opportunities, but also getting into the classroom and helping teachers make more connections to those trips. Our fourth graders study Utah history, and we go to Antelope Island, which is a great place to study that. And in the past, we've gone to Capitol Reef as well, which works great. So what I'll do is try to help teachers design projects that will connect the skills that fourth graders need to learn with the things that we do on our trips. So I'm trying to think of who else.
So do they read a lot of Edward Abbey?
Actually, Everett Ruiz is going to be a big part of the eighth grade trip this year. His journals.
Some Edward Abbey. I don't want to encourage them in that direction too much.
The Monkey Wrench Gang is not, Terry Tempest Williams, maybe, a little lighter.
I was going to say, Leo's being pretty modest because he says all these things are going to be his job next year, but he's already doing these things this year as a fifth grade teacher. So he's been invaluable and put in just probably thousands of hours beyond his normal contract time in keeping this OE program going over the years. So shout out to him.
Yeah. One of the other things we're doing in fifth grade, we go to Arches, and there's been an overcrowding issue there in the last few years. And our kids see that when the park is closed or it's hard to get into. So we studied the issue, what the problem was, and what the possible solutions were. And in fifth grade, we do persuasive writing. So each of them wrote a letter to the superintendent of the park explaining how they thought what the solution should be and how to get there. So we'll see. They're doing that right now. We'll
see what solutions they come up with. Yeah.
I think you can take full credit for that.
Yeah.
You know, Park City Day School solves
right?
all of the problems.
If they put in a shuttle system, we're on it. Right. It's ours.
Do you integrate your service learning at all into your trips, or is that mostly local?
That's mostly local.
Yeah.
We have in the past, when the eighth graders went to the Four Corners area, we did it there as well, but mostly service learning is local. Mm-hmm.
So you don't just kind of focus on the outdoor and experiential education there. There's also, I think, a sustainability sort of bent to a lot of your work. Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned, Robin, that some of the kids have been working on designing energy efficient, sustainable, tiny homes. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the eighth grade project. And they're actually going to be presenting it today in our middle school or our lower school multipurpose room at, I think, 2:15, if anybody wants to stop by and see what they come up with. But they've actually used design software to create blueprints for tiny homes. And Leo and I were just talking outside about how the things that they learned through this project are, you know, basics, like walls have thickness and you have to account for that. But also they're trying to think about what is the footprint of a residence and the people who live there, and how can we make changes that can maybe improve that footprint for the broader community and make sure that we're using things in a responsible way. And it was really interesting. I was not in charge of this project. My colleague Jesse LeVake takes the lead on this one, and Jim Zimmerman was helping out this year as the math teacher. He was really able to help them do a lot of the calculations and things. But watching them as I was kind of walking through the commons area, they had all this tape on the floor, masking tape, just kind of showing the size of their homes. And everybody would walk by and be like, oh my gosh, these are so small. And then the students would like jump into their tape and they'd say, and this is where the bed's going to be. And this is where the bathroom is. And look, they like pretend to sit and they're like, there's totally room to do everything you need to do. And the kids that weren't doing the project were getting so excited. And they're like, I want to live in a tiny home someday. This sounds awesome. And so it's really cool to see them kind of take on a challenge like that of, here's a problem, like how can you create an awesome tiny home that people actually want to live in, and to see them be successful.
Maybe they can make a presentation to a city council for affordable housing.
Exactly. And actually, we've joked about it before. Miss LeVake lives down in Salt Lake, and she said, one of these days I'm going to just have them actually build one of these here on campus. I don't have to commute anymore.
Right. So, yeah. Well, I'm a city dweller. I grew up in New York City. So the original tiny homes,
yeah,
New York
exactly.
City apartment or Tokyo, perhaps.
Yeah. So what are some of the like creative or, you know, interesting ideas that have come out through this tiny home project? I mean, has anybody like done something totally different off the wall?
I'm not going to get to see the plans until the presentation later today. I've been in charge of the sixth grade project, which is a totally different project, but I'm looking forward to it. I did see some students really brainstorming toilet position. And so I'm interested to see what they were like. They had their tape and they had this little stool that they were pretending was the toilet. And they're like, well, can you put your knees over here? Because they wanted to get that extra 6 inches for something else. So I'm looking forward to seeing their plans and seeing.
I think shipbuilding is next.
Exactly. What they decided to do with that toilet.
So I'm curious, how do you integrate your greenhouse into the school? Do you eat the produce? Is that part of your lunch program? Is it just purely demonstration? How does that
last week, because the growing season is really short up here in Park City, Leo and I were also just talking about this. It's unfortunate that, you know, when the garden is productive is generally when we're not in school. Our lower school science teacher, Joanne Sterall, is amazing at keeping the garden going over the summer so that when the kids come back at the end of the summer, there's so much for them to do. My kindergartner at the beginning of the year was harvesting potatoes, and then they actually took those into their classroom and made a dish together because they do cooking every Friday in kindergarten. And so one of the weeks they actually harvested the potatoes themselves, washed them, took them inside, and actually made, I don't remember what it was off the top of my head, probably mashed potatoes or something like that. And that was so exciting for them. And so each group gets to do a major contribution like that to the garden. They plant things in the spring and then they're harvesting things in the fall at the beginning of the next school year, which is a cool way to kind of bridge things across the years as well. Joanne also sells plants from the greenhouse. So the kids start the plants and then we sell them to our community for their gardens. So she has some great tomato plants. She sold out, I think, in like 10 minutes. By the time I was done with dismissal, I got down to go buy things and all that was left was dill. So I got a couple dill plants for our garden. Right. But we do, she does start plants and sell them out to members of our community that can then have them growing in their garden all summer.
Well, I was just going to ask, what are the opportunities for like engagement with the community? If people are excited about this, you know, can they come and see the tiny home presentation or are there opportunities for the community to get involved?
Certainly. Our marketing director, Tess, often sends out emails and things like that. There's a lot of things posted to the school website that can be found about activities that are happening. And we have open door days once a month where people can just come in, check in at the front desk, and wander through the school and see what's going on in all the different classrooms out in the greenhouse and all across campus.
And the day school is K-8?
Yes. Actually, it's preschool through 8.
Preschool.
So we have 3-year-olds on campus as well.
Nice.
Fantastic. Well, is there, you know, a spot you'd recommend for people to learn more about the school and your environmental outdoor education?
Yeah, our website is parkcitydayschool.org, and really just stop in and visit. It's best just to take a tour of the campus and see what we're about.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Leo Mosier and Robin McGinn from the Park City Day School. Keep in touch, and we hope to hear from you again next year about next year's projects.
That's right. The tiny homes.
Yeah,
when they come online.
That's right.
Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, this is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we are proud to support KPCW. With our new 352 Main Street entrance, the Spur now features 3 bars serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
I'm Katie Wang.
And we've got a few minutes left, and we thought that this week we wanted to talk about the Paris Agreement. And, of course, the United States has withdrawn from this. But most importantly, we wanted to talk about some of the more positive spin on this. There's been an incredible response from the private sector to this withdrawal from the Paris Agreement and a group of people saying, we're still in. That's the hashtag. That's the website. That's the name of the group. We're still in.
Right. Well, it's funny. I read that the other day on Facebook and it says, I'm still in. But I read it as, I'm still in. I was like, what's I'm still in?
Still in.
It sounds very rockin'. But no, I mean, it is, I think it's, you know, disheartening that the U.S. government has decided to withdraw from this international treaty. But as you said, I think the positive news is that as a nation, you know, we're seeing leading states like California, Washington State, cities like Salt Lake City, Park City, New York City, stepping up and saying, you know, that's not, you know, we are part of this. This is our future. It's a global issue, and we're part of that that globe, and we're gonna take action. And so to see the coming together at the grassroots, kind of the middle to grassroots level of these communities, I think it's 30 mayors, 3 governors, 80 university presidents, and 100 businesses on the day that the U.S. pulled out came together, and I'm sure more have signed on since then, to say, how can we still be part of it? And so now they're having to reimagine the climate accord, saying, well, we're not really prepared for communities to be part of this. It's really just kind of nation state to nation state. So kind of changing the conversation of like, you know what, it affects all of us. So if this is how we can be a part of it, the only way we can be a part of it, then let's figure out how to make that happen. And so it is really interesting to see this kind of problem solving at an international level.
It is really interesting to see how that communication is evolving with, you know, without leadership from our federal government on this front, you know, private citizens, you know, state governments, corporations are stepping up with these statements. And I think, you know, the last headline I saw about the We're Still In group said that there were over 1,000 signatories and counting. And this isn't, you know, these aren't just small groups, you know, maybe a tiny nonprofit. These are signatories like the state of California, the state of New York,
right.
Fortune 500
right.
companies.
Mars company, a candy company, but global, right. Because they're going to be affected globally. When you think about car companies, you know, they're going to have to build cars that meet the emission standards of all these other countries.
Right.
So if the U.S. is not pushing them, you know, California has its own rigid standards that they've had to comply with for years, you know, it's still going to affect them even if the U.S. government is not imposing those restrictions on them, other nations are. And so it's logical, but it's unexpected at the same time to see them stepping up and saying, all right, let's do this. And, you know, Bloomberg Philanthropies saying, all right, we can kick in the money if we need to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that was incredible to see that, you know, Bloomberg just said, you know, well, if the U.S. isn't going to cover the $15 million for the United Nations agreement here, I'll cover that.
Right.
I got it.
Right, right. And this has happened before. I mean, I think it's what's great about our democracy, about our country, is that we do, when we don't see action at the top, that quite often you'll see action from the grassroots. And that's how change happens. I mean, we've seen it with various wars. We've seen it certainly with environmental issues. And this is certainly no different. So I think that that's you know, a positive note, but I think that's part of our history. That's kind of who we are as a nation, that we're doers, and, you know, we kind of forge together to form positive solutions.
So. Absolutely. In a strange way, it's like this has, I don't know, galvanized or energized the, you know, the citizens of our country, the corporations, you know, the private sector, to act in a way that has never been done before. So while Well, nobody wanted to hear that news about pulling out of the accord, you know, it's having some interesting responses.
Seeing where we have common ground.
Absolutely.
With, you know, not the usual suspects. So.
Well, we wanted to bring you that piece of bright news at the end of the show today, but it's time for us to wrap up, and we'd like to thank our underwriters and our sponsors. We'd like to thank Republic Services, Recycle Utah, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, Mark Miller Subaru, Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, San Francisco Design.
And as always, we of course want to talk about what it is that you want to hear. So email us with your thoughts, your comments, your suggestions for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
This is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. We've got your Wasatch back.